debt, war, corruption, treason, and an open season on human rights. Tears at the fabric of our nation, and the tragic realization is that future generations will pay the big price. Wake up and shake it up, America. From north to south, from east to west, from sea to shining sea, our government is a fight for we the people who can't ignore that we shall reap what we sow, so we better sow carefully. This land is your land.
This land is my land.
If we come together and work together, we can pull the weeds that threaten to destroy our land. I hope and pray you understand we cannot reap a good harvest with a bunch of bad seeds. Wake up and shake it up, America. From north to south, from east to west, from sea to shining sea, our government is a fight for we the people who can't ignore that we shall reap what we sow, so we better sow carefully.
Abraham Lincoln proclaimed, "We are a government of the people, by the people, and for the people, not of the corporations, by the corporations, and for the corporations." He also observed, "You can fool all of the people some of the time, and some of the people all of the time, but you can't fool all the people all the time."
Wake up, shake it up, America.
Our government is a fight for we the people who can't ignore them. So we better sow
carefully. Wake up and shake it up, America.
North to south, east to west, from sea to shining sea, our government is a fight for we the people who can't ignore that we shall reap what we sow. So we better sow carefully. Wake up and shake it up, America.
Another episode of Taking Back America, the official show of Take Back America for the People. We are a 501c3 nonprofit dedicated to educating the American public and people around the world about the costs of allowing corporate control of the U.S. government. I'm your host, Dr. Rick Stagenborg. Today we're going to be talking to someone who's working on a very different approach to dealing with this problem than we've talked about before, and I think it's a very important one. They're fairly well known, but they should be better known, the Community Environmental Legal Defense Fund. Our guest today is Kai Huschka, who is Northwest Regional Organizer. He's the author of several books on hiking. He's got a marketing background, and he's been an organizer for quite some time, including in his local area of Spokane, where they have a community rights organization. So we'll be talking about what they do and their strategy for trying to take back America at the local level. Kai, thanks for joining us today.
Yeah, Rick, I like your opening music there.
Well, that's Bob Wickline. We've had him on the show before, too. He's a great guy, and one of the reasons I like that music is because it's country style, and a lot of people think that people who live in the country are a bunch of rednecks who, you know, really aren't into looking at the bigger picture and their social responsibility. And of course, that's not true, like all generalizations. And you know that for a fact because you work in a lot of rural communities, don't you?
Yeah, exactly. You know, the our organization name may somehow denote that we're dealing with, the more stereotypical, as you say, environmental sort of crowd. But the reality is the vast majority of our work has been working with small rural communities in all kinds of different states. And so we're very familiar with the fact that there are a lot of folks out there especially concerned about their inability to be decision makers in their own community, and seeing how corporations wield so much more greater power than they do from all kinds of fronts. And so that's what folks are confronting today on a very real level.
Absolutely. And I recommend that people go to the website of Community Environmental Legal Defense Fund. sometimes called CELDF, CELDF.org. And they talk about the work that we're going to be talking about in detail today. They also talk about where they're working. And it's really a wide variety of places, all the way from the East Coast all the way to the West Coast. There's several places just here in Oregon that they're working. And according to the website, they're trying to, in addition now to working in these local communities, they're trying to connect these communities within states so they can work at a statewide level. Is that right, Kai?
Yeah, correct. I think as we get into our discussion here today, it will become more apparent about sort of how things are formulating and being organized, and really ultimately the necessity around the need to start looking at how does state level as well as eventually federal level change look like in relation to this idea of our right to self-govern in our communities, especially as we look to try to make truly more sustainable communities, and how that runs right up against the corporate control and corporate power, and how they wield that both directly through their constitutional rights that we'll talk about later, but also indirectly in how they use both state and federal government to really override our decision making. That basically the end equation is that our communities are really the property of corporations. And that may seem like a strong statement, but when you really peel it all back, that's the inner workings of what we have today, which I would guess for a lot of folks is really antithetical to what they think the it means to live in America and to be in a democracy.
Absolutely. Well, there's great promise, I think, in these kind of efforts, and in general, where corporations are coming in and destroying the environment of local communities. This is where we're seeing people who think of themselves as conservatives and people who think of themselves as liberals working together on things like fighting Keystone, fighting LNG terminal here in Coos Bay and at Cove Point in Maryland, fighting fracking all over the country, and pipelines for fracking and fracked gas and oil, all kinds of projects that you're working on are bringing together people who think of themselves as conservatives and liberals and helping them understand that their ideological orientation is not as important as their need to work together to overcome the power of corporations at all levels, as you say, from local level to federal level. Well, one of the things that's unique about CELDF's approach is that they are your approach is not to fight regulation or to increase regulation, but to actually assert autonomy and, boy, I'm blanking on the word, sovereignty of the people. So can you tell us a little bit about the difference between those two approaches?
Sure. I think it's you know, this is a discussion, even though we have about an hour here today, that could actually take days to really get down into the finer points to really make the picture more clear. But the shorthand sort of response to that or kind of explanation is, as we look at our communities, specifically when we're confronted with corporate projects or corporate proposals for certain projects, as you mentioned, the Jordan Cove export terminal and pipeline that's proposed there for Coos County and Douglas County and, you know, Jackson and Klamath as far as the pipeline route goes, and other fracking projects, just because that is kind of the new thing that's popping up all over the country and something that we deal with on a daily basis. When communities are then, you know, faced with this new, you know, quote-unquote neighbor coming to town, and someone who they look at and say, well, wait a second, this doesn't seem right from a lot of angles, whether it's the broader climate situation we're in, and of course the constant barrage of information we get around the need to get away from fossil fuels, or whether it's, you know, something very localized, especially with the pipeline projects where corporations are wielding state power to seize people's property, the use of eminent domain to drive these pipelines in, for instance, under the guise of it's for the greater public good. You know, there's all kinds of reasons that communities come together, as you said, whether they're of a liberal mindset or conservative, and typically where we end up, or potentially even where we're driven to by other types of organizations, is into this, what we call this regulatory world. And in that regulatory world, the bottom line is you do not have the ability to be the decision maker. You do not get to say no to what it is that you find to be threatening to your community, because the regulatory world is about regulating something, not about saying no to it. And so much of our organizing and our activism is driven into that world, whether it's by other conventional environmental organizations, whether it's by the corporations themselves, along with the fact that our state and federal agencies that are overseeing this stuff become the place, then the venue of which we go to, whether it's to testify or, you know, to file lawsuits to block the, you know, issuing of the permit. And so that has become the story of how supposedly we are to address these things that we find threatening. And of course, in the end, it's not about saying no. The projects get cited, and if anything, it becomes this negotiation about how badly we get impacted by it, and not about us being able to say no, and in large degree controlling what corporations do versus being controlled by the corporation. And there's a lot of legal doctrines that, you know, gird and support that particular world. So the communities we have begun to work with, because the realization is it's the structure that is the problem. It's not the issue, really. It's the structure, including that regulatory world. Folks have moved in a very different manner, and really in a different manner, but one of which is innate in the sense of what we thought this country was founded on, which was this idea of self-governing power, especially at the most localized level. And so folks are driving in new law to assert that inalienable right to be self-governing, to reject these corporate projects, and to actually protect the rights of the community on the basis of their health, safety, and welfare. And so that means, one, asserting ourselves in a very different manner than we have through things like the legal system, but also with the understanding that we have to come up against that structure of which the corporate form has found itself in greater and greater power over time. It's not always been that way, but corporations have found a way to assume more and more power within our structure. And when I say structure, it goes down even to the constitutional level. And so therefore, we become, as I mentioned earlier, really the property of the corporations versus us actually controlling the property that is the corporation. And so in some ways, the tables have been reversed, where it's the corporations that control us. And this is about actually seizing that power that's rightfully the people's and putting corporations in a position where they actually work for the people, not the other way around, and of course in a manner that's going to be sustainable for the communities, whether you're looking at things socially or politically, economically or environmentally. Where we're headed now because of that corporate control is, of course, in a very dark, gloomy direction that doesn't look to be stopping unless we actually stand our ground and start pushing back.
Absolutely. Well, you mentioned something that might be a bit alarming to some of our listeners, especially people who consider themselves more conservative. And that is the idea that a big part of the problem is built into the Constitution itself. It's kind of scary to think about changing the Constitution or even its interpretation to someone who's basically philosophically disinclined to accept radical changes. But you said also that the way the Constitution has been interpreted has changed over time. So the argument could be made that if you really want to be conservative, you should look to what the founders intended, and that was clearly to control corporations, not to have them control us. Now, the piece of the Constitution that I'm aware of that's most useful to the corporations in assuming control of state and federal governments is the Commerce Clause. Do you agree, first off, that that is a big part of the problem?
Yes, and that's, in fact, corporations wield that particular constitutionally bestowed power more so than other elements of the Constitution. And when I say other elements, we get into the whole corporations are persons discussion, which is primarily the Bill of Rights elements to the U.S. Constitution. But you're correct. The Commerce Clause becomes sort of the main battering ram of corporations to get their way within communities, so that if there's a particular corporate project, you know, again, back in Coos County, you know, around the pipeline and the export terminal, you know, that is all going to be framed as commerce and corporate commercial pursuit, and therefore the corporations will wield, whether they're a foreign corporation or not, they're going to wield the commerce clause of the U.S. Constitution to say that, hey, you at the local level, you have no say over this. Even if you don't want it, the Commerce Clause is going to override your ability to actually say no to something like the pipeline, because that's not your authority to do so at that level. So that is a constitutional provision that has been picked up and used by corporations for decades now to keep moving their agenda against the will of what the people want in particular communities.
Now, I think we need to take a step back, because I think a lot of our listeners probably don't know what the Commerce Clause is or the rationale behind it, and it's kind of important to understand that. So can you explain to people what it says roughly and why they put it in the Constitution?
Sure. It's a provision under Article 2 of the U.S. Constitution, which lays out all the powers of Congress. And one of those powers is something that's been called now the Commerce Clause, which is about a three-line statement around the regulation of basically interstate trade and commerce, and also trade with foreign nations. So the rationale for it when it was written was at the beginning of the country here, the folks who sat around the table to draft up the U.S. Constitution were looking at the landscape, both literally in the sense of the natural resources around them, but also the reality that they had just gone through the Revolutionary War, and there was lots of economic strain that the new fledgling country had to get over. So the mindset of the time was, well, we need a very efficient means to be able to really extract those natural resources to get them to market. So the commercial value of that is necessary to build up our power, to then, of course, make us less vulnerable to potential invasion or attack. So it was about building up a strong nation. So the mindset was, well, it's going to have to come commercially. So in order to do that, we need a system that protects that, and we're going to constitutionalize that mindset. So this, of course, is the late 1700s. Here we are in the 21st century, and we're still living under that same mindset of a resource extraction type mindset, and using the Commerce Clause as the main means to protect that view of the world. And what has happened is corporations have picked up on that over time, and regardless of what it is, and regardless if it really truly benefits, you know, the greater whole or not, that's what corporations use to justify their actions. And of course, underneath all of that, whether those folks in the 1700s understood it or not, is really this mentality of the endless production of more that the Commerce Clause, you know, exudes. And of course, we don't live on an endless planet.
Right.
So the question is that provision still feasible in what we understand the real world we actually live in? And should corporations be wielding that much power over that of the people to make those kinds of decisions, supposedly on the behalf of the public good, and that, you know, all commerce needs to be protected in that highest manner? That includes, you know, all the extractive stuff you talked about earlier, all the fracking, all the pipelines, all that stuff is protected by the Commerce Clause, regardless of what damage it's been doing to communities on an environmental level, on a public health level, on an economic level, on a quality of life level. It's almost this blinder sort of mentality that it's, you know, commerce, 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 you know, regardless of what it leaves in its wake. And that's a real power that's constitutionally protected. So again, it does go down into the Constitution itself. And that's just one element of the Constitution of which corporations use, but also is used in essence to deny another constitutional provision, really, which is what we begin to argue, is that when the Constitution was formed, this idea of the right to local self-government was very much, you know, within people, because they just fought a whole war with with Britain on that whole grounds. And so when they even were formulating the U.S. Constitution, this idea of we the people was really the statement, the definitive statement about the right to local self-government. And so it's genetically in there. It's unfortunately, though, within the legal doctrines, including things like the wielding of the Commerce Clause by corporations, that hasn't had a chance to really operate, especially when communities begin to assert that. We see how the current legal structure wants to deny that, and this work that's happening in Coos County and across the country is about actually, gaining back that idea, not only the idea, but actually the real practice of the self-government, and really also in the same time controlling corporations, which is also something that people were very well aware of during the revolutionary period, because it wasn't just about the British government, it was about the chartering of corporations like the East India Company that were also controlling the colonies. So this corporate control stuff isn't new. It's been around ever since the United States was founded, and there was a real recognition and fear of corporate power back then, as it sits today, rightfully so. And so we have to break that. And in order, I think, to break that, we have to look into the actual, governing documents, whether it's the laws themselves or the constitutional structures, both at the state and federal level, to really put power back where it's supposed to have been, which is at the local level, to have it be the check, really, on the state and federal, as well as entities like corporations. So we got it wrong. We got it upside down, even though the idea was to decentralize power. That hasn't happened. And, of course, corporations have assumed, in a lot of ways, more power than our own federal government, which exudes a lot of power.
Well, that's that's a mouthful. I just want to highlight some points here. You did say that the idea of local self-government is one of the founding principles, and you're absolutely right. One of the reasons that we had a revolution was because the king didn't want to recognize the right of local self-government. We've had town councils and state colony-wide governing bodies since long before the revolution, and it was ultimately the king's prerogative to disband these, and we said no. That's kind of where the pushback started, and in the end, as you say, a lot of this had to do with fighting the power of corporations, in particular the East India Company. The Boston Tea Party was all about special tax breaks to the East India Company when they were exempted from paying the tea tax. People don't think of that. They think, oh, it's about taxation without representation. True, but more to the point, it's about the fact that we were being taxed while corporations weren't, and it was destroying the local, or it was having a real pernicious effect on the local economy. That, in fact, that we were supposed to, the colonists were supposed to use shipping, British shipping, so that destroyed their shipping industry. So you're right. I totally agree that a lot of this was about fighting corporate power. Excuse me. But there are other things too. You mentioned the internal stresses within the colonies, and there really were economic wars between the colonies, and there were also very fierce debates about who was going to pay the war debt when it was over. That was a huge stressor that could have ripped the nation apart before it even got started. And of course, there were compromises made, and those were resolved, but there was still a problem with commerce, and that was that one state could start laws that would make it more difficult for legitimate interstate commerce, necessary commerce, in favor, say, one ferry company in Staten Island over another one in New Jersey. And there was a fear, and I think maybe a justified fear, that this would really affect the nation's ability to become a strong economic power, as you said. So there was a legitimate concern there in terms of commerce, and it's all based, of course, on the idea of competition, capitalism, of which these extractionist industries are part. But I think it was bigger than that, because I just gave an example that didn't have anything to do with extractionism. So there was a legitimate concern. There's a real tension there. Whether anybody agrees with that formulation or not, that's what a lot of people say. In fact, when you gave your presentation here in Coos Bay, somebody brought that up, and I don't think it was addressed. Somewhere there's got to be a balance between states' rights and the right of governments, state and federal government, to sort of ensure that there's not these destructive wars between the states, which doesn't justify. Sorry, go ahead.
Yeah, I think we, I mean, part of it probably needs, I mean, here's the reality is we have enshrined the U.S. Constitution as somehow being sent down from the heavens. We have, you know, there's been an incredible, you know, mythos wrapped around it as if it's untouchable, as if it's you know, was perfection when it was written, and it cannot be touched. I think the first step is that we have to face the uncomfortable truth that there's a lot of facets to it that that are actually quite damaging and quite and the opposite of what we thought government was supposed to be about, which was the protection of rights. Because what we see, at least at the community level, is really the overriding of rights by the corporate interests and the corporations assuming greater rights than that of the community. And they're getting a lot of that power because of the constitutional structure. We also have the longest-lasting constitution on the planet, one that was written at a very different time. To get to a little bit what you were talking about, that it was a different era and a different mindset and different horizon that was looked upon. We live in a very different world, and one I think that we understand more clearly now can't continue on the path that it is. And if we have mechanisms like constitutional structures that are continuing to propel us down this path that we have to get off of, then it should be fairly logical for us to begin to look at those structures and to reimagine what they need to look like. And I think that's also part of the work that's happening here at the local levels. They begin to blueprint this idea of how that structure could look in regards even to commercial pursuits and how that relationship will look and how it needs to be bounded versus where it sits today, which is localizing the control, in the case of Coos County there, really in the hands of a few people on the board of directors of a couple companies that get to dictate what the entire you know, world looks like in this particular issue with the pipeline and the terminal over that of every single person that lives in Coos County. And so I think that should give great pause that if we have structures out there, including the constitutional structure, that actually puts us at that kind of disparity of decision-making, which is, in my view, very much anti-democratic, why wouldn't we want to look at those structures more soundly? That, and I think that does come down to us shedding these the myths, the uncomfortable truths around things like the Constitution, and really looking at it, is it really doing what it's supposed to be doing in protecting rights, and rights first and foremost, beyond that of actually protecting commercial pursuits such to the point that it's actually violating rights. I think there's a major problem there, and yeah, there's things that need to be sussed out, especially around the economic systems that have been built off of the constitutional systems. Can they sustain themselves? Are they sustainable? Are they actually viable for the people and for the planet or not? And so there's a lot of big questions, but what is the fact right now is corporations basically own communities, and the communities who don't want to be owned by the corporations are facing up to them very much in the same way that the revolutionaries did to the corporations of their time as well as to the British government.
Absolutely. Again, there's a mouthful contained there. Let me just make a few comments so our listeners are following us. I'm not sure that people who aren't steeped in these battles against these corporations coming in their local communities understand what we're talking about when we say that it isn't our decision. What we're saying is all we can do to fight these projects is to appeal to the regulatory agencies And their default is to approve these things. If the corporation jumps through these hoops, then their default is to approve them. It's not even up to the, they don't even care if this thing is necessary because it's all about trade and commerce. It's not about anything else. The Constitution has put property rights over human rights. That's, I think, what you were saying. And there was a time at the founding when those weren't such big concerns. There was a whole brand new continent with nothing on it but a bunch of Indians in the way, and they were turned out not to be a big problem for a colonialist expansionist government. But now it's not that way. The United States is almost fully populated. I mean, of course, it can continue to grow, but there is a limit, as you said, a physical limit to how much we can extract the resources and be left with anything we can live on. That's why this is so critical right now. Do you think that that's a fair summary of what you just said, Kai?
Yeah, I think it's communities really understanding that they're the front line to these very serious questions about, in some ways, the survival of people, let alone other aspects of having viable communities. And I think energy, of course, is a huge issue that the communities we work with are facing on a daily basis, whether it's the fracking itself, whether it's the pipelines, whether it's the injection wells, you know, from the frack waste, you know, whether it's large industrial wind projects that are not about localizing energy but by about feeding a power grid for the sake of corporate profit. You know, it's really the community level that are pushing the question in a truer manner towards, well, if we're going to need energy, you know, what kind of energy do we actually need such that it doesn't kill us in the end, like the energy type system we have today? And unfortunately, those who potentially could steer that ship in a quicker manner at the higher levels do not seem to be very interested at all. In fact, they keep fueling that endless production of more mindset and keep extracting those resources. And so I think it is about understanding, if we're going to get energy, where is it going to come from? Can it be done in a viable manner that doesn't destroy the ecosystems that we're a part of and that we rely on, but still, you know, feeds whatever needs we have in that realm? And that's also, in some ways, a world we don't fully understand yet. But I think what's understood, at least by those communities, including the folks in Coos County, is we can't keep doing what we're doing in this extractive model and putting in more pipelines and, you know, shipping fossil fuels over, you know, overseas somewhere just to have the pollution come raining down upon us. I mean, there's more and more science coming out, for instance, about the impacts to the climate in Oregon and along the West Coast because of fossil fuels being burnt across the ocean. So you're not separate from any of this. It's not as if you're shipping your problems off somewhere else. They will come back and get you at some point in some form. Why are we not reimagining what the existence of a community should be about, who should be deciding, and what structure do we need to make that viable? And that's where, again, the communities are coming up against not only the corporate structure but the governmental structure. At the same time, they're trying to put viable plans or at least ideas out there for their own community to address things like energy production.
Well, absolutely right. And we could spend a whole show, and I'm going to spend a show pretty soon, about why we need to convert to fossil fuels. But it sort of brings up one of the bigger roadblocks, and that is when you focus on the environmental issues, a lot of people who consider themselves conservative will say, well, wait a minute, environmentalists are liberal. Here in Coos County, they destroyed the timber industry and the fishing industry because of their regulations. But this is, of course, not about regulation. It's about local sovereignty, and that is the approach we're using. All the same, people who think about this are going to still say, well, wait a minute, is this really about fossil fuels? Now, here in Coos County, we're trying to pass an ordinance that would give us the right to vote on these things, specifically tying that to what kind of energy we need. It's great if we have the majority who agree that we have to get off fossil fuels, but there's a huge debate about that still. There's even a debate about the existence of global warming, even though that's changing, and people are more and more admitting that. The majority, I believe, again, admit that. At one time, it was like 80% back in the late 80s and early 90s, believe the global warming is taking place. Well, it is. I mean, 14 out of the 15 hottest years in history have been since 2000. But what is it going to take to convince people, along with all the other evidence? But the fact of the matter is people are still saying, well, that's not human-caused, and, well, it's really a good thing because now we'll have beachfront property in Nevada. And even the environmentalists, as Naomi Klein points out in her book, This Changes Everything, even the environmentalists for decades now have been saying, well, let's find free trade solutions. Let's let the market fix everything. Well, the market is not fixing everything. We've been buying the myths of free market economy now for decades and seen income inequality and wealth inequality grow to record levels. We've seen the destruction of our public schools, our public highways, everything public, as the banksters and their friends on Wall Street take more and more of the commonwealth, and it's all because of this model, as you said. I don't want to just say, well, we all have to agree that the environment is the issue. I think we need to acknowledge the real problems, getting people to buy into that. But that said, CDELF has had a lot of successes in, as you said, a lot rural communities, which tend to be quite conservative. Can you talk a little bit about those successes, especially the fracking successes, for an example?
So what you just described there, you know, there's a lot of facets to what these situations bring up, and it truly isn't just the environmental, which, of course, that's a huge one because we're not separate from the environment. We're part of it, whether we're conservative or liberal. We can't avoid that.
You can avoid talking about it.
Yeah, the realization is, yeah, there's economic systems and social systems and political systems, and, you know, all that stuff is interlinked and makes the greater complex system that we're a part of. Yeah, and in these rural communities where a lot of this unfortunate corporate activity is happening, because that just happens to be where the natural resources are, you know, those folks are having to have these kind of discussions that you were just bringing up. And in a lot of cases, you know, there isn't the definitive answer because it's so monumentally screwed up that, of course, it isn't going to be changed by, you know, Grant Township in Pennsylvania, or by a small community in New Hampshire, or just by folks moving a sustainable energy future in Coos County at that. But I think folks understand that we can't keep riding the train that we're on, and that it is more than just the environmental. And in fact, there's all kinds of economic opportunity when we start to actually localize our activities. And not to become insular, but to understanding that the more self-reliant and self-energized and the self-determined we become, the healthier we become to then link up to those other adjacent communities. So it's really almost a simple biological realization of what makes biological health as far as ecosystems go. Well, you know, human systems should be running very similarly. And I think, you know, we don't see that because we have been fed what you said is sort of the market solution type mentality, which has driven things to be more and more centrally controlled, which in essence pulls more and more the decision making out of our own hands, which means we're less self-determining, self-guiding, self-governing, which I think grates at anyone across the political spectrum, you know, including those that are more conservative. And so I think that's been the binding agent to the work that we've seen with communities, is people want to be the decision maker because they understand that if they continue not to be the decision maker, they will continue to be under the thumb of smaller and smaller numbers of people making very bad decisions for them, and in large degree it's the corporate form. And so we're seeing both this direct standing in front of and rejecting and taking corporations head on, you know, along with that, the assertion that our right to self-govern exists and we are going to exercise it. And then the third piece, in a lot of ways, around the sustainability aspect and the viability of communities is the assertion of what it is that communities want to see, whether it's their energy systems or their food systems or their local economies or whatever it might be, is them asserting, well, this is the direction that we're going in and we're going to be the decision makers. And just to kind of wrap up to what you started with, you know, when you look at the timber industry and the claims that somehow the regulations killed it, well, look at where all the timber's going. It's going overseas. So, you know, one of my questions when I look at that in a lot of Oregon communities is, why aren't you doing something with the wood products? You know, why isn't the economics actually benefiting you versus getting sucked out of you? You become truly a resource colony for the timber corporations. That has nothing to do with the regulations. It has all to do with this, the further accumulation of power in the corporations to dictate that world, to then kill any sort of viable timber industry, because I think there is very clearly ways to do sustainable timber that benefits the community, as well as not killing off the environment that needs to be healthy to sustain that particular kind of industry. But in large degree, it's the corporations who have designed something very different for themselves, of which you guys have been left in the wake, and of course the blame gets pushed on somehow that it was about regulations. And I think that's a very narrow view of truly what's happening there. So there's a lot of big questions that get brought up when communities begin to actually assert their ability to be decision makers and actually lay out plans for what it is, what they want for themselves. And again, like I said, at the same time, challenge that the corporations somehow have greater rights to decide than the people in that particular community.
Absolutely. You know, it's interesting you should bring up the idea that that it's regulation. People see it as regulation is the problem, when in fact, it could be argued that lack of regulation is the problem, because that's the essence of free trade. Leaving corporations to basically do whatever they want, regardless of the effects on local communities or states or the country, for that matter. They want to remove all barriers, and this is why logs are being shipped out. We can easily pass a law saying, no, they have to be milled here in Oregon, or there has to be some kind of a tax, an export tax. But the fact of the matter is, under free trade agreements, we can't do that.
And why aren't you able to have a right to sustainable forestry, for instance? You know, insert your right to say, okay, well, we want forestry. We find value in it. We can do something with it, and we can do it in a way that doesn't kill off the ecosystem. But the economic gain, you know, needs to stay within Columbia or Coos County there. And, you know, of course, that's not how the world looks. But, you know, why aren't you able to do it? And, of course, you know, as you said, you start to get into international free trade agreements. You start to get into the other constitutional structure stuff. So it starts to spin back to the very same thing that the fossil fuel fight is around the pipeline and terminal go to. And that, I think that should wake people up saying, you know, that's just wrong.
Well, absolutely. And, you know, what it is, one way of looking at it, again, you know, there's lots of ways of looking at this, but I kept hitting at the Commerce Clause, and I didn't really get deeply into it, and I suggest that people read Gabbling Down the Rabble by Jane Ann Morris to truly understand this. It is a really complicated story. But the fact of the matter is, what she points out early in the book, is that the Supreme Court's interpretation of the Commerce Clause for, you know, over 100 years at least, has been that, well, what it really wants to do is establish free trade zone in the United States. No restrictions, no local restrictions, no state restrictions. There have been absolutely ridiculous decisions where they say, you know, a farmer's right to put aside a bag of grain, I don't know if I have the details straight on this, but it's as crazy as this, to feed his chickens is interfering with interstate commerce. I mean, there really is a case that's very similar to that. It's just crazy. They're trying to label everything interstate commerce so that the federal government controls all these aspects of trade instead of local communities. And because this is the structure where large corporations can buy our officials in Washington, where they capture the regulatory agencies and they're put in charge of regulating themselves, because that's the way it works, they get to determine what our choices of jobs are. they get to say, well, we're gonna come in there, we're gonna extract all your timber, we're gonna extract all your natural gas, we're gonna run a pipeline across your property, we're gonna put GMO crops in there and take over your agriculture. We can do this because that's free trade, and basically free trade means we can do what we want.
The justifications for that is efficiency. You know, you always hear them talk about efficiency, and to have more local control, for instance, well, that just creates a patchwork of laws which will break the efficiency, you know, quotient to that particular trade, and we can't obstruct trade in that manner. So it's always the rationale given is that efficiency model that somehow, again, keeping it in fewer hands, centralizing it, streamlining it, all that is really then sold as being the gain and benefit to all. But of course, we see that it's not. It's just the opposite that occurs. And so that's another one of those things that we have to confront, that somehow local decision making is a bad thing versus actually seeing it as a good thing to control and protect the resources as well as the economic vitality of communities. You know, when you start to look at local economy, there's, like everything else, there's tons of evidence that shows, you know, the more that you nurture and support that and reinvest in it, the better off, you know, a community is. We know all this, but again, the structure would deny that even. So if you start to assert your, you know, right to a truer local economy, well, again, you'll run into that structure says, well, you can't do that, that the Commerce Clause or other things will come into play to say, well, you have to play this particular game, and I'm sorry, you know, Coos County, if you want a greater local economy, well, you can't have it because that goes against what the more dominant system says you're going to get, regardless of your decay and impact by that fact.
Mm-hmm. Well, you know, I love how you put that. This drive for efficiency, what it's doing is creating monopolies that are protected by the federal government, where they're picking the winners and the losers. These giant mega corporations allowed to do whatever they want, come in and rape your community, extract all your resources for their benefit, instead of us getting the maximal payback for what we're willing to give up. They say, oh, we're going to come in and create jobs. You should be grateful. You should give us tax breaks. You should, you know, let us do it. This is how they treat third world countries. And people are allowing this to happen. Right here in Coos County, which is a sort of a purple area, our so-called liberals are almost uniform. Well, I shouldn't say almost uniform. There's a lot of so-called liberals in the Democratic Party, in the unions, who are supporting this because just for the jobs. They're so desperate for jobs, and they can't see that if we had local control, we could generate jobs by investing in green energy, for instance, green energy production. So this is so wrong on so many levels from either a conservative or a liberal view. It's just incredible. But, you know, we've talked a lot about economic issues, and we've sort of talked on the edges about the environmental issues, but we didn't really get into one. I wanted to make one other point. We keep saying extractionism. That means taking the natural resources from an area for your own use, wherever you can make the most money out of it, instead of keeping that money local, which is one reason why local economies are so important. You keep it local, there's a multiplier effect. You spend it in local businesses, and all those businesses have more money to spend. When you have giant mega corporations coming in, they just suck it out. Walmart does that. Georgia Pacific does that. Georgia Pacific is not based in Oregon, obviously. You can tell from the name. And they're one of the biggest timber companies in the state. They're the ones that are benefiting from these policies. But, Kai, I wanted to – there's another controversial thing I think we need to get to while we still have several minutes left, and that is – the Community Environmental Legal Defense Fund advocates for the rights of nature. This is kind of a radical concept, at least I know for some of my conservative friends. Can you explain what rights of nature means?
Sure. You know, from the standpoint of how it's ended up in Oregon, is its origins have come from actually rural Pennsylvania. So when we talked a number of times since we've been talking about, you know, where is this work happening, what's happening in quite often very conservative Republican, you know, folks that are NRA-type members, you know, that sort of, you know, I guess, stereotype of mindset, you know, those were the first communities to actually move this new, which is, again, not new, not really a new thing, but this idea of nature's rights. And the reason why they've begun to move this kind of new law around the protection of the environment is, as it stands today, the environment is property under the law. And because it is seen as property, you know, those who wield the most property in the end can destroy the most property, which then, of course, all spins back to who's wielding the most property today in one manner or the other. Well, it's the corporate interest. And the idea is, so long as we have this property orientation of the environment, again, of which we're not separate from but are part of, we'll continue to have this control and this ability to do that extractive type of operations. So folks are moving on a very different ground around the protection of the environment from that of having rights, so nature of actually having rights to actually exist and persist and flourish just in the same way that we believe we as people should have. And so these laws are ending up in the local community bills of rights, whether it's the issue dealing with, you know, land application of sewage sludge or fracking or pipelines, that we have to actually begin to look at environmental protection from a rights-based perspective and no longer this property orientation, because it is that property mindset that actually is not only destroying the environment but destroying us as part of that environment. And so this is a new paradigm for folks to have to wrap their heads around. And it is one that often folks like to attack, saying that it's, you know, these folks want to give rights to rocks, and, you know, next thing you know, the, you know, you can't shoot a squirrel. So there's this sort of immediate kind of fear reaction to this idea that we should be protecting the environment from a rights-based perspective and not the property-oriented way that it's happening today. But it's also interesting that as communities have to wrestle with this notion of environmental protection from a rights place, over time there starts to become a greater understanding, well, that is a truer way that we actually have to not only protect that environment but actually have to live with that environment, because, again, we're not separate from it. And if the corporations in large degree are using a very different type of law that's about using that environment as property for their own gain, to our, you know, to our impact, then we need another means of which to protect the environment that we're a part of. And if it means moving it to this higher level of a rights-oriented position, then we need to start doing that. And it was really a very easy decision for those first communities in Pennsylvania. It was almost a no-brainer to say, well, yeah, you know, that watershed is important to us. And it needs to be healthy for its own sake, but of course, you know, our interaction with that watershed, whether it's, you know, the drinking water or our fishing on that particular watershed or whatever it might be, then, you know, if there's new ways in which we have to protect that the current ways of doing it aren't, then by all means we need to start moving that direction. So now you have about, you know, over 24 communities in the United States that recognize nature's rights. But it is sort of a new thing, and it rattles people's brains, even though when you, again, look at it very, I would say, commonsensically, it's why wouldn't you protect the environment to that level, knowing that you're not separate from it, but you're actually a part of it?
Well, I certainly agree with you from the practical perspective, at the very least, even if the philosophical issues are difficult to comprehend. I think part of the problem, and this gets to the root of, I think, all of the resistance to what CDELF is trying to do, all these common sense things. Everybody wants local control. Everybody wants democracy. But they've got all these ideas that, well, you can't do this and you can't do that, and therefore we can't use that as a solution. The free market, you know, if you don't question the assumptions of the free market, you won't get the fact that there is a solution. If you don't question the idea that not only humans have rights, but it makes sense for the environment to have rights, then you won't see that that's a solution. Now, you made a couple of points in your presentation here in Coos Bay that I think are very important that you didn't include in this. And that is, number one, you said people don't think that environment has rights. How can they accept corporations have rights? Corporations have rights according to the Supreme Court, constitutional rights, and yet the environment doesn't have rights. We don't need giant mega corporation monopolies to survive. We didn't have them for a long, long time in American history. And there's lots of evidence that they're more destructive than they are creative. So there's the argument that if corporations can have rights, of course the environment should have rights. Why? Because that gives them standing in a court of law. That's a point you made before that I think was really important. Do you want to explain that to our listeners?
Yeah, no, I think you did a very good job. I mean, we're seeing that play out right now in a small township in Pennsylvania where the gas corporation is trying to assert its quote-unquote rights over that of the communities to put injection wells. This is that frack waste water into that community, and the community is saying, well, we don't want your frack waste injection wells, and we've passed a community bill of rights to that effect. And included in that is, you know, the rights of nature, and specifically in their case, because there's a current lawsuit going on, the local watershed is actually intervening in that case. And the judge currently was looking at the particular case and looking at these various arguments, you know, as we've been talking about constitutionally, and is actually taking it very seriously that there's some very serious constitutional arguments going on here between this clash of the right to local self-government and so-called corporate rights. You know, where does it all sit? As well as in looking at kind of a discovery phase of sorts that's going on, the Oil and Gas Industry Association from Pennsylvania wants to intervene alongside of the specific gas company, and the judge in a particular interchange they were having said, well, that's a fine idea. In fact, if that industry wants to be, or that association wants to be part of this case, well, so should the citizens group who's trying to intervene, as well as the ecosystem. So very much about, well, if you want to be heard as property, because we have to remember that corporations are property, and that property can't speak without somebody speaking on its behalf. So in essence, it's typically the corporate attorneys who speak for the property that is the corporation. We are, you know, a lot of folks want to say, well, corporations are made up of people. Well, that's fine, but technically a corporation is property, and someone has to speak for that property. And so in the judge's eyes, well, then people should be able to speak for the ecosystem, in this case, the particular watershed. So it is one of these things that needs to happen, you know, a thousand times a day to get people to understand really where we sit and how screwed up it is that a corporation has assumed this kind of status as a quote-unquote person, but the environment, we have to change that. And then collectively, we have to start doing something about it, which is, in essence, what these communities are doing through the local laws that they're passing, including that of recognizing nature's rights for the protection of those ecosystems and other natural communities, as well as the benefit of human communities.
That's a way to challenge all the ways in which federal and state powers used against local communities. I mentioned the Commerce Clause. A couple of times we mentioned corporate constitutional rights, and we didn't mention the Dillon Rule, which is state supremacy over local laws. And, of course, there is federal supremacy over state laws. So there's a whole mess here that this challenges all at once, and it may be a difficult battle, but I'm glad you came on today, Kai, to tell us about the battle that CellDesk's doing. How can people help? How can they get involved?
Obviously there's a local effort in Coos County there. The Coos Commons Protection Council is the citizens group moving the Community Bill of Rights forward there.
This show goes internationally, though. Let me just say real quick, we're out of time. People go to the celdf.org, and you can find out if there's something in your community. If there isn't, you can find out how to communicate with the national office and organizers like Kai. We're out of time.
No problem.
Thank you so much for being on Taking Back America.